Hello, and welcome back to the History of Comic Books podcast. This is your humble host and narrator, J.T. Wheatley. In our last episode, we got into the origin of Superman and how he came to be, and now we're going to get into the history of Superman and how he evolved into the hero we know today. While the first appearance of Superman would be instantly recognizable to readers today, there are still a lot of differences that separate him from the modern version. He originally worked at the Daily Star and not the Toronto Star from Joe Shuster's hometown, but would later be renamed the Daily Planet in Action Comics No. 23 in April 1940. Most significantly, Superman was very much anti-establishment, fighting lynch mobs and evil businessmen. He also didn't have much regard for human life, like he did in Zack Snyder's Man of Steel, more recently, and will be seen throwing people about at one point, destroying a plane and carrying escaping criminals, which would have likely killed them. He was a character that, like all fictional ones, had a lot of growing up to do after his birth. By September of 1938, Superman's creators Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster traveled to New York City to meet with national editor Vin Sullivan, Jake Liebowitz, and Harry Donenfeld to discuss the future of the character. They had also arranged with Charles Gaines through his Killer Syndicate to make a Superman strip by 1939, eventually appearing in 300 newspapers across the country. Not bad considering he was originally rejected by every paper that sent him one. While Liebowitz and Donenfeld were dreaming of ways to capitalize on their character, with Action Comics No. 1 having gone through three printings and 900,000 copies sold, Siegel and Shuster would produce a story that satirized his merchandising when he finds out that someone has been using a fake Superman to push his products. It ends with a hilarious bit when the fake breaks his hand on the real Superman trying to punch him, and showing Siegel and Shuster had predicted the future of their character before it even happened. By 1940, Superman got one of his first nicknames with Man of Tomorrow, which came from the World of Tomorrow slogan from the New York World's Fair Comics. He also got his first venture in other medium in February of 1940 with the Adventures of Superman radio show on New York's WOR. Sponsored by Kellogg's Prepped, it starred Bud Collier as Superman. It would run to 1951 for a total of 2,088 episodes. It was here that his classic slogan, faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, impervious to bullets, up in the sky, look, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. The show was an instant success, and would later spawn significant characters in the Superman canon, the young photographer Jimmy Olsen and Clark Kent's boss at the Daily Planet, editor Perry White. It also introduced kryptonite in the spring of 1943 to give him a weakness. Jerry Siegel tried to introduce such a concept with the K-Metal storyline that was unused, that also had Superman reveal his identity to Lois Lane so that it's become partners. It was never used, but it is interesting to note that Jerry proposed this story right after he married his wife, Belle, in June of 1939. Siegel and Shuster did introduce his classic villain, Lex Luthor, in Action Comics No. 23 on February of 1940. The radio show also expanded his power set, adding X-ray vision, super hearing, and flight, which would soon be copied in the rest of the mediums. It also was a surprisingly progressive show, with Superman battling a version of the KKK and the classic story Clan of the Fiery Cross in 1946, which received praise from Newsweek magazine. This was approved by director Robert Maxwell and focused the prejudice on Asians, though the theme was universal. Other changes the radio show had over the comic book was that the Krypton was now in the Earth solar system, and Superman was more active in World War II, with his classic tagline, Truth, Justice, and the American Way, being added in 1942. Also, on March of 1945, he teamed up with Batman and Robin. In January of 1941, Paramount contracted Max Fleischer Studios to make a Superman cartoon, which reportedly spent up to $50,000 per episode, a fortune at the time, and used the voice actors from the radio show. The show was an instant success and even nominated for an Oscar in 1942 with its breathtaking animation, which still holds up nicely today, along with introducing for the first time Clark Kent using a phone booth to change in Superman. Superman flew in the cartoon as well, reportedly requested by Fleischer, who said it would be easier to animate flying over him having to leap multiple times. However, there was another reason the Man of Steel started to fly. On February of 1940, Captain Marvel debuted in Wiz Comics No. 2 by C.C. Beck and Bill Parker from Fawcett Publishing, featuring the adventures of a young Billy Batson, who, when he uttered the word Shazam, which would later become his modern name, he would magically turn into Captain Marvel. While the character bears some resemblance to Superman with his facial features and cape look, he had a different color scheme, red, white, and yellow, and powers, which were based on magic and not science, and it included the ability to fly. It didn't help that Captain Marvel was soon outselling Superman as well. As a result, National decided to sue Fawcett over the copyright infringement, though it soon became apparent that it was Superman doing the copying. Nevertheless, it eventually ended with National winning, and Fawcett was forced to settle with a fine of hundreds of thousands of dollars and the promise to cancel the Marvel comics. In 1940, Ben Sullivan was placed with editor Whitney Ellsworth, who joined with Lieberwitz with coming up with an in-house code for National. Significantly, that none of their characters would kill, though Superman and Batman had already raked up a significant body count by that time. Read those originals. The world's finest were literally not pulling their punches. They also made a point of keeping Superman out of the war, making him instead a USO representative in 1942 during World War II. This was logical, since how long would Hitler have lasted if Superman was really sent after him? Thus, it became more human and appealing to kids, as Superman would soon be fighting bullies. However, he also got more absurd, with villains like Mr. Mixiplex was introduced, who frequently self-referenced the fact that they were in a comic book. He did get his Man of Steel nickname, which from Steel Sterling, a minor hero of Pep Comics. Then, in late 1994, the young Superman, Superboy, was introduced. Originally conceived as a sidekick to capitalize on the popularity of Batman and Robin, he was later reconceived as a young Superman who was discovering his powers in Smallville, Kansas. He even got a pet dog, Krypto. Once again, this is something else inspired by Captain Marvel Comics, which makes one wonder how Fawcett lost his lawsuit. By 1942, Superman was so rooted in American pop culture that the New York Yankees' Joe DiMaggio was called Superman as a nickname, being one of the first examples of the character's name becoming an adjective to describe anyone, celebrity or otherwise, as having what they call superhuman prowess. By 1948, Superman got his own serial, short films showed in movie theaters, with Kurt Allen cast as the Man of Steel, becoming the first live-action appearance of the character. To avoid the censors, his X-ray vision couldn't see through people's clothing, for some reason, but it also added that he had the more common weakness of lead, which would become a consistent feature in the comic books. Due to cost constraints, any sequence of him flying was animated. Nevertheless, the serial was a huge success, and it spawned a sequel in 1950, Atom Man vs. Superman. Also in that same year, Bill Finger, the co-creator of Batman, wrote a Superman comic that explained his home planet of Krypton and emphasized the fact he was an orphan, something that his own creator, Jerry Siegel, would expand on in the late 1950s when he returned to the series. This was also explored in the novel The Adventures of Superman by George Lofer. In 1951, The Adventures of Superman, the TV show, premiered, starring George Reeves, and would air for 6 seasons. It began with Superman the Mole Man, which once again found him protecting the underdog, this time the Mole Men in the title, who were the target of a roving mob. The first 2 seasons were filmed in black and white and more film noir, with murders, kidnapping, suicides, and worst of all, they even killed a dog. A crippled old lady was even killed in the episode Evil 3. Superman's no killing philosophy didn't quite translate to the TV show yet as well, as when 2 criminals discovered he was Clark Kent, he flew to the top of a snow-colored mountain and then left them there, where they would soon fall to their deaths. All this was edited for content by September of 1952, with Robert Maxwell being replaced by Whitney Ellsworth, and the later plots were made to be more feel-good, with the villains more comical, and Superman thus being made squeaky king for the now in place comic book code authority, otherwise known as CCA. The series also, ironically, saw a loss in production value when it started filming in color in the last 4 seasons, as all the sets and costumes had to be colorized as well, resulting in loss of money for action and other effects. So much so, Superman would guest star in I Love Lucy on January 14th, 1957, and by the 6th episode, a more serious tone was taken again, along with George Reeves directing some episodes. Sadly, after the show ended, George Reeves would commit suicide on November 17th, 1959. Despite being a heroic symbol, Superman was still the target of Frederick Wervham, the writer of The Seduction of Innocence, claiming he had what's called a Superman complex, believing what might makes right, but National's tireless work on his image, much due to Whitney Ellsworth, kept him above the fray for the most part. Ultimately, it would be the crime and horror comics that would suffer from the CCA, the result of the scrutiny, with hero books like Superman being the ultimate survivors and winners. In 1959, Jerry Siegel returned to writing Superman, helping to revive the character during the Silver Age. It included a classic story in which Superman traveled back in time to his home planet of Krypton, only to witness it being destroyed again. It emphasized the fact that Superman was an orphan, giving a much-needed layer of depth, while also seeing the sales increase due to the improved storytelling. Much of this was due to editor Mort Weisinger, who during the Silver Age worked to give Superman a more coherent past and world, essentially a mythology that would make him credible. Employees hated him due to his micromanaging and outright lying. His friend, fellow editor Julie Swartz, joked that his tombstone should read, "Here lies Mort Weisinger, again." However, Mort Weisinger believed Superman was the star, not the writer or the artist, and the sales did increase, keeping Superman as one of the top-selling books in the 1960s. He also made Superman more realistic, giving him a social security number, 09209-6616 for anyone who wants to steal his identity, and a UN passport. Mort did try to keep him out of current politics, but at one point was enlisted by the Kennedy administration as a fitness ambassador, who was even featured as a character in comic books. Sadly, this all came to the same around the same time that Jack Kennedy was assassinated, thus quickly ending this. As a definite plus, though, Weisinger also openly debated Frederick Warren over the merits of comic books. He even hired a then unknown 13-year-old Jim Shooter as a writer. During his reign, the villain Brainiac was introduced, along with Krypto, Superman's dog, and his cousin Supergirl, along with multiple kinds of kryptonite. In 1966, one of the stranger developments of the Superman franchise was It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, the musical. Written by David Newman and Robert Benton, and with music by Charles Stross, it premiered on March 19th. While receiving generally positive reviews, it never caught on with the public, as to paraphrase one critic, it was too campy for adults and not campy enough for the kids. Thus, it closed on July 17th after only 129 performances. It was revived as an ABC TV special on February 1st, 1975, with David Wilson's Superman and Leslie Ann Warren's Lois Lane, but viewers said it lacked the energy of even the stage show. However, it was the big screen where Superman would make his movie return. In 1978, Superman the movie was released, setting a new standard in comic book movies, though it was a long road to get there. It started in 1974, when the Sol Kings, Alexander and his son Ilya, were looking to develop a new movie property, deciding they should try Superman. Having already produced Orson Welles' The Trial and the blockbuster The Three Musketeers, they were no strangers to the movie game. But when Ilya suggested Superman to his father, he first had to explain who he was. Nevertheless, it wasn't long before they got some European backers and were approaching Warner Brothers, who awarded the movie rights for 25 years for $850,000 up front and a back-end deal that could include millions. They then spent millions advertising the film, including signing Marlon Brando for millions to play Jor-El, $2.7 million guaranteed on 11.3% of the domestic gross and 5.6% of the foreign. They then hired Alfred Bester to write the screenplay, but then moved on to Mario Puzo of Godfather fame, whose story became the basis for the film but was deemed too campy. Nevertheless, he still got $300,000 up front and 5% of the gross. Finally, they hired Robert Benton and David Newman, the writers of the failed Broadway musical It's a Bird, to fix it. Meanwhile, they looked literally everywhere for a director, from Roman Polanski to Steven Spielberg. For a while, Guy Hamilton, the director of Goldfinger, was signed on, but he couldn't film in London due to taxes. He wanted to film in Italy, but Marlon Brando couldn't because he had an outstanding warrant for sexual obscenity. Since Brando was already locked in for millions to play Jor-El, Superman's father, for just 2 weeks of work, they decided to part ways with Hamilton and finally settled on Richard Donner, the director of the hit horror film The Omen, who brought on Tom Mankiewicz to help to rewrite the screenplay. The millions up front and the 7.5% of the gross didn't hurt either. A few days later, Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman was signed to play Lex Luthor for $2 million, reassuring the investors that such high-caliber talent was part of the film. Finally, there was Superman himself, and the Salkins literally considered and tested everyone, from Sylvester Stallone to Clint Eastwood to Ilya's dentist. Seriously, look at the special features of the Blu-ray. They have his test screening. Finally, they found Christopher Reeve, who they originally dismissed for being too thin and even considered it a muscle suit for him. However, Reeve, being a natural athlete, promised he could bulk up by the time of the movie. Of course, he proved to be an inspired choice, and it was his skills as a hang-glider pilot that made Superman flying look so good. The rest of the cast quickly filled up, with Margot Kidder as Lois Lane. However, before the film could be completed, they managed to squeeze another $15 million out of Warner Brothers. Finally, Superman the Movie premiered on December 15, 1978, with its creators Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster invited. DC had begun making overtures to repair the rift between them. Siegel reportedly left the film with tears in his eyes, saying it was everything he had hoped for. It was a critical and financial success across the board, grossing an astounding $300 million worldwide. Adjusted for inflation today, that would be $1.2 billion. It set the standard for all comic movies to follow. Both Sam Raimi and Patty Jenkins cited as a major influence for their respective films, Spider-Man and Wonder Woman. And the score by John Williams is considered the best to date, his best to date. So much so that when Hans Zimmer was hired to score The Man of Steel in 2013, he originally declined, stating that in the world of movie composers, John Williams is our Beethoven and Superman is his Ninth Symphony. As for the Salkins, after promising everyone on the film the world, they walked away with their shirts still intact and not much else. However, they still had the rights to Superman for another 20 years, and they intended to milk it for all that it was worth. Well, of course, with the success of Superman, a sequel was in the works. Technically, it was planned all along, as Superman 1 and 2 were scheduled to be filmed at the same time in a cost-saving measure, a technique that would later be copied with Lord of the Rings movies and the Avengers Infinity War films. However, in the rush to finally deliver a movie, the first one was released, with the second one having mostly been shot but still unfinished. With the film being released, Salkins waited to see what would happen, and once it became an overwhelming success, they made the move to replace Richard Donner with Richard Lester, known mostly for directing the Beatles movies. Many has long speculated that if the film had bombed, Donner would have been allowed to finish the second one, but now that it was a financial success, they felt they could put their own man in place. Margot Kidder publicly denounced this, and when Superman 3 came around, her role was greatly reduced, something that she probably was thankful of in hindsight. This led to some complications. For instance, Marlon Brando wouldn't allow his scenes he had shot be used for the second movie, and thus Susanna York's role as Lara, Superman's mother, was beefed up to replace him. Gene Hackman's scenes were already shot, though, and any adjustments were provided by his double. Despite all this, Superman 2 was released on January 19, 1981, a critical and financial success, making $208 million worldwide. Eventually, Richard Donner's cut of the film was released in 2006. The Salkins also found a way to milk the first one when they released a 182-minute cut of the film to release on ABC. Naturally, with this success, a third was on the way, with Superman 3 on June 17, 1983. Due to her protest, Margot Kidder's role as Lois Lane was greatly reduced, with Annette O'Toole playing Lana Lang, Clark Kent's boyhood crush from Smallville, where Robert Vaughn, the star of the TV series The Man from U.N.C.L.E., played the villainous industrialist. Of course, Christopher Reeve was back for over $1 million in script approval, along with director Richard Lester, who got a $1 million paycheck as well. The real star, though, was Richard Pryor, the brilliant comedian, who mentioned in a guest appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson he would love to be in a Superman film. The Salkins saw this and offered him the gig, along with a $4 million paycheck, of a computer programmer whose skills Vaughn's characters needed to take over the world economy. It ended up being a B-movie mess, unable to balance Richard Pryor's comedy with the overall tone of a Superman film, with both critics and fans reviling it, and it only making half of what Superman 2 did. The franchise looked dead, with even Christopher Reeve proclaiming he would never play Superman again. However, the Salkins, who reused most of the costumes and sets from the previous movies, actually managed to make money on the series, so they weren't quite done with it yet. Nevertheless, the Salkins tried a different tack with Supergirl, released on November 21st, 1984. This time fell on the adventures of Superman's cousin, Kara Zor-El, played by Helen Slater. Despite its prestige cast, which featured the great Faye Dunaway and Peter O'Toole, it was another critical and financial bomb, and now the movie franchise looked really dead. Interesting enough, though, despite only grossing $14 million to its $35 million budget, the Salkins always claimed that thanks to some genius in counting, they actually did make money on the film. It appears that they're giving everything away for the first movie, the Salkins were finally cashing in on Superman. Finally, the Salkins got tired of making Superman, so they sold the film rights to Cannon Film for $5 million. He went on to make Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, in 1987. While an ambitious film with a story about nuclear deterrence inspired by Christopher Reeve himself, along with him facing off with Nuclear Man, a villain referencing the Atom Man from the 1940s. It was ultimately another failure that Reeve would dismiss as well, and reportedly told his parents not to watch 3 or 4. Back in the comics, Julie Swartz was leading another revival of the character, with Carmine Infantino now serving as publisher. They hired writer Denny O'Neil, who built a career out of reviving DC characters, and set about eliminating Kryptonite by having it turned into iron while depowering Superman. He even changed Clark Kent's profession, making him a TV anchor at Galaxy Broadcasting System with his new boss, Morgan Edge. O'Neil also gave the Superman Clark Kent a personal struggle over who was his real identity. They even explored the racial issues, including his own Jewish heritage, with one story having Superman fight a golem, a monster from Jewish myth that was created by Lex Luthor. This was something Michael Uslan would use to teach his first accredited course on comic books at Indiana University. Originally, the dean said that comic books weren't art, but when Uslan pointed out how much Superman's origin matched Moses from the Bible, he got the job. However, as soon as the movie came out, any changes that were made were quickly reversed. As Alvin Schwartz stated, Superman directed his own destiny. We were just pawns. Siegel and Schuster's simple creation had truly become a force of nature, one who would team up with famed boxer Muhammad Ali in one episode, in one comic. Plus, as predicted by his creators Siegel and Schuster all the way back in their original run, Superman was soon a license out for advertising, both for his own comic and other products. This is part of Jeanette Kahn's larger plan for DC Comics, understanding the best way for them to make money now was to use them as IP intellectual property generators for other mediums, while at the same time using ads to keep the comics profitable. It was a new world, and Superman was at the center of it. Understanding the need to show these characters could work and make money under the mediums, Jeanette Kahn, who was publisher of DC, had the Super Friends cartoon created in 1973, which would run off and on until 1986. While derided by fans today, much of Aquaman's ridicule can be traced to this show, it was another huge success, of course leading to increased merchandise sales from toys to clothes and so forth. In 1986, Crisis of Infinite Earths was launched at DC, a maxi-series designed to revamp the continuity of DC comic books over the decades and trying to give it some sense. As part of this, John Byrne, fresh off his successful runs with Marvel's Uncanny X-Men and Fantastic Four, was hired as the writer-artist of the Man of Steel miniseries, and later the regular comics, where he once again depowered him while making Clark Kent the real identity over Superman. Lois Lane was now a more aggressive rival reporter, while Lex Luthor morphed into a corporate tycoon over mad scientist, and he also got rid of the super pets. It was a reboot so significant it made the national news, with New York Times, LA Times, the Washington Post, and even Time magazines running stories on it. At the same time, the Smithsonian read a special year-long exhibit called Superman, Many Lives, Many Worlds, highlighted the many versions of the character, and like all previous versions, it didn't last. Soon, Byrne left, and Superman was quickly revamped back to his old ways for the most part, and the artist no longer looked on his run with any fondness, saying everything he did would get erased. In 1988, the Salkins, the producers of the first three Superman movies, produced the Superboy TV show, with scripts by Mike Carlin and Denny O'Neil. It was a show that homage to the comic books, depicting the adventures of a young Clark Kent attending Siegel's School for Journalism at Schuster University, a nice nod to the creators. While campy, it was actually quite successful and lasted into the fourth season after reaching 100 episodes. After this, the Salkins sold the rights back to Warner Brothers after financial issues within the family, when Ilya's wife, Jane Chaplin, the daughter of Charlie Chaplin, loaned Alex Salkin $7 million for the movie Columbus. When the movie bombed, she demanded her money, which Alex claimed he didn't have. As a result, he was sued by his own son and daughter-in-law, leading to a business and personal split between them, and ending any chances of producing Superman movies. In 1991, the Death of Superman storyline at the Superman's Writers' Summit was conceived, when the original plan was to have them married to Lois Lane in Superman number 75 was next, when the Lois and Clark New Adventures of Superman TV series was announced. Jerry Ordway originally suggested the story as a joke, but it lingered. After all, Superman had been killed off in the comics before. Why not? Soon, Dan Jurgens and Mike Carlin began crafting the story and decided if Superman was to die, it had to be by a new enemy, Doomsday. Reportedly, Mike Carlin called Jerry Siegel to explain the plan, including his eventual resurrection, and Siegel said go ahead. However, what became a simple event story soon became a media sensation, with the New York Times reporting on it. Carlin stated, even at that early point, that we can kill Superman and bring him back, pointing out the overall story would end with his resurrection. However, Jeanette Kahn had to deal with an angry phone call from the Warner Brothers CEO, upset that they were killing him off without asking him first. And Kahn had to reassure him again that the plan was to bring him back eventually. The comic, Superman number 75, was released on November of 1992 to record-breaking sales and 9 million copies, with a special issue released with a black polybag and armband. Following this was Funeral for a Friend storyline, in which Superman was buried and mourned by his family, friends, and fellow DC heroes, including a story where his father, Jonathan Kent, had a dream of saving his soul in the afterlife. Then the Superman comic books took a three-month break and relaunched with The Reign of Superman, a nod to the original story in which Jerry Siegel and Joe Caesar first conceived the character. Each comic featured a different Superman, with Cyborg and Superman, The Alien in Action Comics, Superboy in The Adventures of Superman, and Henry Irons in Man of Steel. While not as successful as Superman number 75, each issue sold a million copies apiece, and readers were soon left to wonder which one was real. However, by Superman number 82, it was revealed that none of them were real, with the real Superman returning, now with long hair, while Cyborg was the villain Hank Henshaw, Superboy was a clone, and Henry Irons became Steel, a new DC superhero. It ended up being one of the most successful years for DC in comics, and reportedly, Jerry Siegel loved the whole thing. Meanwhile, on ABC, the show that started this whole mess, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, premiered on September 12, 1993, with Dean Cain as Superman and Terry Hatcher as Lois Lane, and John Shee as Lex Luthor. It ended up being fairly successful, especially with young audiences. It had nice nods to the past, particularly cameos by Phyllis Coates and Jake Larson, the Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen from the George Reeves Superman series. By the fourth season, the characters were set to be married, but in a nice bit of ironic justice, the episode kept getting pushed back so that Clark and Lois could finally be married in the comic books first. The shoe was now on the other foot. On December 1996, in a 96-page comic book called The Wedding Album, Clark Kent and Lois Lane were finally married. And then, on February of 1997, they got married on the show as well. Nevertheless, that wasn't enough to save the series, which was canceled after the fourth season. Dean Cain still has fond memories of playing Superman, and is now playing Kara Zor-El's adoptive father in the CW series Supergirl, and doesn't believe there has ever been a curse to the role. He also likes to point out that technically, he played the character longer than anyone else. Now, you may try to argue, but what about Tom Welling in the Smallville series that ran for 10 years? Well, like he said, he plays Superman longer than anyone else. Tom Welling only played Clark Kent and was never once called Superman the entire series. So, yes, Dean Cain is right. Meanwhile, the TV and animation rights to the character reverted back to Warner Brothers, and they decided to turn the franchise over to the able hands of Bruce Timm and Paul Dini, who had already created the brilliant Batman the Animated Series. Released on September 1996 on the now-defunct WB Network, which later merged with the UPN Network to form the CW, as part of their kids' lineup. Tim Daly voiced Superman Clark Kent, while Dana Delaney voiced Lois Lane, and Clancy Brown voiced Lex Luthor. It was a critical and financial success and helped to further establish the shared animated universe set up by the Batman series previously. Especially when Batman showed up in the Classic World's Finest storyline. It lasted until February of 2000, but that would not be the last the animated Superman. An elderly Superman would be seen in the futuristic Batman Beyond series, leading a new Justice League team. And he would later appear in the Justice League animated series and the Justice League Unlimited shows in the Cartoon Network. In 1995, the Canadian Post decided to honor its Toronto native Joe Shuster with a Superman stamp, showing that Canadians have some claim on the character as well. Sadly, something terrible happened in 1995 as well, when Christopher Reeve suffered a spinal injury from a horse riding accident, leading him to be paralyzed from the neck down. Despite being crippled, Reeve became a source of inspiration, working for causes and repairing spinal injuries, and even continued his acting career, including starring in the ABC TV movie remake of the Alfred Hitchcock's classic Rear Window. Sadly, he passed away on October 10, 2004. Back in the comics front, in 1996, Kingdom Come was released by Mark Waid and Alex Ross. Taking place in the near future, he's an older Superman in retirement after the Joker went mad in Metropolis and killed Lois Lane. When a new hero named Magog kills the Joker and is later acquitted, Superman quits believing he has outlived the world. Of course, by the end, the need for the heroes like Superman are reaffirmed, and Superman has fathered a child with Wonder Woman. In 1997, for some reason, DC decided to change Superman's look and powers, basing them around electricity and giving him a blue and white costume. It was quickly ridiculed, and none less than Saturday Night Live mocking it on their weekend update segment, with Norm Macdonald stating, "Why did DC change the costume? Not gay enough." Macdonald would then turn to look at the new Superman and proclaim, "That's not Superman." Sure enough, DC quickly reverted him back. In 1998, the team brought you the classic Batman The Long Halloween, The Dark Victory. Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale turned their talents on The Man of Steel, with Superman for All Seasons, a four-part miniseries that retold the first years of Superman, with each issue focused on a different season. A brilliant story that returned the character to his fundamentals, it remains one of the highlights of the Jeff Loeb-Tim Sale pairing. On October 16, 2001, Smallville premiered on WB, which told the tales of a young Clark Kent glowing up in Smallville, with the added twist of a young Lex Luthor moving there and the two becoming best friends. Clark was played by Tom Welling, with his parents, Jonathan and Martha Kent, played by Jonathan Snyder and Annette O'Toole. And an interesting twist, Terrence Stamp would play the voice of Jor-El, previously the villain General Zod in the Superman 2 movie. And Annette O'Toole also was a nice callback, as she played Lana Lang in Superman 3. Lana Lang in this series, though, will be played by Kristen Crook, but the most significantly was Michael Rosenbaum as Lex Luthor, giving probably the best live-action performance of the character. Designed to give the origins of both characters, Rosenbaum's brilliant performance showed how a once likable young man became a supervillain. The show also had nice touches, such as Smallville's high school paper being called The Torch, the same name as the paper at Jerry Siegel and Joel Shuster's high school, and even had Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder guest star. It would go on to last for 10 seasons, though Welling would never don the costume or even be called Superboy, let alone Superman, since the Siegel family had won the rights to the name briefly in court during this time. Nevertheless, the show was a success, and over its 10-year run would feature guest appearances from The Green Arrow, The Flash, Cyborg, and so forth. Lois Lane would also join the series by the fourth season, played by Erica Durance, whose take-charge attitude and sassy persona made her instantly likable with fans and critics, with many arguing she gave the best live-action performance of the character. The show finally ended on May 13, 2011. In 2013, Superman continued to show that he was the most popular character of all time, with Action Comics number 1 was auctioned off for $2.2 million at a record-breaking price for any comic book collector. On June 28, 2006, Superman Returns premiered, directed by Bryan Singer of X-Men fame and starring relative newcomer Brandon Routh as Superman and Oscar-winning actor Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor. Meant to be a direct sequel to Superman 1 and 2 and ignoring 3 and 4 like they never existed, something even Christopher Reeve wished, it held those films in complete reverence, from incorporating John Williams' brilliant score to Luthor's plot still being about land. However, it was that reverence that ultimately hurt the film, when many fans were upset that Superman never even punches anybody and leading to a box office disappointment. Nevertheless, Brandon Routh has since returned to the DC fold in the CW series Legends of Tomorrow, where he now plays Ray Parker / the Atom. On October 26, 2015, Superman's cousin got her own series with Supergirl, premiering originally on CBS before moving over to the CW, with Vanessa Benoist in the title role. While an uneven series at best, it continued to be a modest ratings success to this day, and Benoist's winning performance is a continued highlight. Plus, her cousin finally showed up, played by Tyler Hoechlin, in Season 2. With the failure of Superman Returns, though, the movie front decided to get rebooted again, and on June 10, 2013, The Man of Steel was premiered, directed by Zack Snyder. Snyder, who previously made a successful adaptation of 300 by Frank Miller, and a somewhat successful adaptation of The Watchmen, turned his talents into Man of Tomorrow. Superman was played by Henry Cavill, with Amy Adams playing Lois Lane, and Russell Crowe playing Jor-El. Michael Shannon was playing General Zod, and Kevin Costner and Diane Lane played Jonathan and Martha Kent. It was shown that Superman did punch people more than a few times, but this time it went overboard. As when Superman battled Zod throughout Metropolis, there was one destruction casualties occur, something that many fans criticized that Superman would never allow to happen. It didn't help in the previous year, DC's chief competitor, Marvel, had their movie The Avengers depict their heroes actively keeping casualties down and working to reduce them. Man of Steel did end up being a modest success, though, and set up for the eventual DC-EU shared universe, hoping to imitate what Marvel was doing with their MCU. The sequel, Batman vs. Superman, premiered on March 25th, 2016, with Ben Affleck cast as Batman and Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor. However, it was reviled by critics and many fans, objecting to Eisenberg being miscast and also squeezing too many plots into it. As one critic would put it, the problem with the story wasn't that it was bad, it's that there was at least five good stories in it, from Death of Superman to The Dark Knight Returns, squeezed into one movie, resulting in a complete mess. Nevertheless, it managed some financial success, though it didn't crack that coveted $1 billion worldwide mark, a must for any modern-day blockbuster. Remember, adjusted for inflation, the original Superman made $1.2 billion. Despite being killed in the movie, though, he would be resurrected in Justice League on November 17, 2017, and was openly a critical and financial disappointment, and now put the entire DC shared universe in jeopardy. And that more or less brings us to the end of the present-day character. One interesting note, a new Superboy has returned, Jonathan Samuel Kent in the Superman comics, the son of Clark Kent and Lois Lane, as DC has finally relented and made him into a father. Granted, this is part of the whole 52 Convergence multiple universes mess, so we'll see how long this will last. Though he is an interesting character, and he's actually get paired up with Damian Wayne, Bruce Wayne's son with Talia al Ghul, in the comic book series Super Sons. A long way coming since his first appearance in Action Comics number 1, in which he changed the industry forever. And like any great fictional character, he has outlived his creators and will likely live on for decades, if not centuries, to come.
My name is Mark McCrane. I'm the author of The Best Saturdays of Our Lives.
I'm Dan Klink, co-host of The Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast.
The Best Saturdays of Our Lives features programming trends from the 1966 television season all the way through the last hurrah of the early digital age of the 1990s.
On the show, if it's animated, we talk about it.
Order your signed copy today at tbsool.com.
And listen to the podcast at esonetwork.com and all podcast platforms.
And now it is April 25th, 2024, time for the favorite comic book of the week. Ultimate Spider-Man number 4 by Jonathan Hickman and David Mussina, which finds Peter Parker and Mary Jane going on a double date with Harry Osborn and his wife, Gwen Stacy. Yes, that's right. In this universe, Harry Osborn is married to Gwen Stacy, but keep in mind, if back in the original 616 universe, Harry and Gwen knew each other before Peter ever met her, and they even dated for a period, so this actually does make sense. Especially since we're dealing with a universe where Peter never became Spider-Man, and that's more or less fell in love with the girl next door, Mary Jane Watson, and got married and had two kids. Well, of course, they go on a double date, which has some undertones because both Peter and Harry know each other as the Spider-Man and the Green Goblin and their larger mission. It's just a fantastic issue. It's just these two on a double date. No comic book action of any kind, but some great character development and dialogue and stuff that is missing in a lot of era comic books, especially the current mainline Spider-Man comic books. Hickman does a great job with these characters. He nails MJ and fleshes out the world. Like, you learn what MJ's job is, which is perfect for her. This version of Gwen Stacy's fantastic as well. And it's like, well, I don't see a great match for Harry. And it kind of like, in some ways, you look at their relationship and go, oh, wow, Harry and Gwen are a pretty good couple. And it kind of makes you question maybe Peter and MJ need him working on a few things here or there, too. Especially considering he's now become a superhero. And Messina's art, while he's not Marco Duchetto's dynamic action, it doesn't need to be that way here because, like I said, it's just a date. There are basically two couples having dinner and talking, and it's fantastic. It's everything you wish the Spider books are for, especially the current Amazing Spider-Man, which that current run by Zeb Wells can't end soon enough. But as long as thankfully we have Ultimate Spider-Man, which is like this is the Spider-Man we know and love, and thank goodness it's on the stands. And with that, we will conclude with this week's edition of the Archives. Join me again next week for another edition of the Archives. Until then, go on and enjoy the comic book. And of course, I've talked about it many times before, check out Ultimate Spider-Man. It is fantastic. It's the Spider-Man. It truly is the Ultimate Spider-Man comic right now.